Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
I'd like you to open with me in your Bibles to Mark's Gospel. We will be in Daniel here very shortly, but I'd like you to turn first to Mark's Gospel, chapter 13, Mark 13. And the reason we're turning here is because the passage we're going to look at this evening in Daniel, which is in the second portion of this incredibly important vision, or actually revelation, that was given to Daniel, probably by Gabriel. In this second portion, which we're going to look at this evening, he talks about the end times. In a lot of ways, it's the most mysterious section this week, next week, and the following week. In a lot of ways, the most mysterious. And in many ways, of course, the most exciting. Everybody's fascinated with how it will all end. People want to know about the end of the world. They want to know and they don't want to know about the end of the world. And these passages that we're going to be looking at really are instrumental in understanding what the scriptures have to say. These are probably the most important ones in terms of receiving such detail as we can find about the events that will transpire just before the end of this age. This age is the age in which sin essentially rules in the world. The prince of the power of the air, as the Bible refers to him, Satan, has his way pretty much in this world, with the exception of the people that belong to Christ. This age comes to an end, and another age will be ushered in which the Lord's rulership will be experienced tangibly. The transition between this age and the next age is what we call the end of the world. It's kind of an interesting thing, but it's the end of the world as we know it, the end of the age, and the beginning of the age or the world as it should be. So because of that, what I would like to do is go back to what is known as the Olivet Discourse, a section of what Jesus said, and we'll read it out of Mark. It's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three of the synoptics, but I want to read it out of Mark's Gospel this evening. What happened was that in the last week of the Lord's life, he was with his men, of course, constantly, and at one point they were, of course, the whole time they were in Jerusalem, but at one point they were at the temple area, and the men looked at the temple and they were amazed by it, and it was an amazing, awesome thing. The temple that Herod had rebuilt, though he was a godless man, he invested a huge amount of money in the temple in Jerusalem, a lot for his own prestige, but also to please the Jewish people as best he could. And this edifice, this temple that was there, was just a really phenomenal thing. I mean, people would come from around the world to see it, and it was quite impressive. It's huge, and not the building where the ark was necessarily, but the grounds all around it, and just really cool. And so they were there. The men were with Jesus, and they are looking around at this. And Jesus takes the opportunity when they ask him about how things are going to end. He you'll see here that what he does is he tweaks their interest a little bit, and then they walk away for a while, and then they ask him some very specific questions. And in the process of answering that question, is what he says is known as the Olivet Discourse, because he gave them this little talk when he was on the Mount of Olives. So let's have a look at what he says, and then I'm going to draw some things out of it, and then we'll go back to Daniel, and we'll see how the connection is. So Mark chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. As he was going out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, behold, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And they, like I said, were wonderful. By the way, the only part of this structure that remains visible of the original work that was there when Jesus was there is what is known as the Western Wall in Jerusalem. It was actually a form of retaining wall that Herod had built. And if you've ever been there or have seen pictures of it, the stones, some of the stones, single stones that are part of that retaining wall are the size of this wall behind me, the single stone. They're huge. They're absolutely immense, many, 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 many tons apiece. So it was very, very impressive that they mined these and milled them and were able to put them together without grout. And you could not set, I mean, they had grout, they just didn't use it. The craftsmen were so precise, they didn't need it. You couldn't slip a piece of paper in between the stones that were used to build these buildings. The craftsmanship, the technology that they had was absolutely phenomenal. So when they said, look at these buildings, on the one hand, from a human perspective, it was very, very impressive. And sometimes when you look at what man can do, it is impressive. I mean, the technologies and the sizes of the buildings that we can make, there are buildings in our country that are big enough to put several European cathedrals inside of them. Humans are capable of doing this. This ability is all on loan from God. Truly, it's on loan. I mean, he made us creative. He made us like him. And he made us able to think. He made us able to do things. And so we've done this. And then we're very impressed with what we do. And that's why when Jesus, he looks at the men. Now, they're looking at the building and he's looking at them. Which is a really, you got to bear this in mind. They're looking at the building. He's looking at them. And in verse 2, Jesus said, you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another. There's none of them that are going to last. Well, that's the last time I'm going to point anything beautiful out to the Lord. I mean, it's just been one of those days, I guess. You can see the guys looking at whoever it was that said this. And the Lord looks around and says, yep, it's all going to fall. It's all going to come down. That's a sobering thing. It's kind of like a glass of water in the face. It's kind of like, well, do you expect me not to be happy about all the good stuff that humanity has done? It's not that so much. It's that humanity without God creates not just buildings, but whole philosophies and ideas and religions that end up competing with God. And this temple that was there represented not just a physical building, which was impressive, but it represented really Judaism's idea of what it thought Judaism ought to look like. And here was the Messiah standing there, who is the living one. He is the plant that was planted by God. He's the fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah, the vine from the parable in Isaiah, the vine. He said it, and here he is standing there, and he knows they're going to crucify him within the next couple of days after these things are being said. So this is just a really powerful moment. When he says this, he's not just pouring water on their enthusiasm. He's pointing out an eternally true reality. Don't be too impressed with what humanity does, even though humanity can do some impressive things by our standards. Verse 3, now, they were up on the Mount of Olives, from which you can see all of this. You can see the temple, and as a matter of fact, they had gold that covered the main front pillars of the temple. And when the sun would come up, it would glint off of that. You could see it very clearly from the Mount of Olives, and it was really impressive. Even today, if you go to Jerusalem, they build the buildings out of what is known as Jerusalem stone, which is a kind of a goldish color. And you have to face all the buildings there with this stone. No matter what you build them out of, you've got to cover them with Jerusalem stone. And it's mined in the area. And the beautiful thing is that when the sun is setting, it makes the whole city look golden. Really, I mean, not bright gold, but this mellow golden look to it. And the temple in these days, when they were looking at this, they had buildings built out of this. And then the temple was this bright white with these huge gold pillars out in front. It would have just been really impressive. And Jesus had said, this whole thing's coming down, which it did within one generation. In 70 AD, these things completely were torn apart by the Romans. So the men are up on the Mount of Olives. Now they're looking down at this thing. And apparently when he said it's going to fall apart, it piqued their interest. So when they got with him alone, they said, what is going to be the sign that these things are going to take place? Verse 3, he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, looking at it, you see, or able to see it. Peter and James and John and Andrew were questioning him privately. What a great thing to be able to do. Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled? He had talked about destruction. He's talking about the end of the age, and they want to know. And Jesus began to say to them, see to it that no one misleads you. Many will come in my name and say, I am he, and they will mislead many. See, he's already assuming he's going to be gone. They're not even sure that this is happening, that he's going to be gone. He's looking past it. He's telling them things they won't understand till after the resurrection. But he says, many will come and impersonate me. They'll say I'm the Messiah, and they will mislead a lot of people. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be frightened. That's an interesting thing to say. Do not be frightened. Those things must take place, but it is not yet the end. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be earthquakes in various places and also famines. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. It's just the turmoil that is part of the fallen world. But be on your guard. They will deliver you up to the courts. You will be flogged in the synagogues. You will stand before the governors and kings for my name's sake, and you'll be a testimony to them. Now skip down to verse 14. There's a lot more in there, I know, but we're not going to do the Olivet Discourse tonight. Just hold me back. Verse 14. It's a great study all by itself, but I want to point something out. Look at verse 14. He says now, he's warning about what it'll be like in the end, and he says, but when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it should not be, and then Mark inserts these words, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. You see the words abomination of desolation. Where do those words come from? Daniel. You should recognize them immediately. They're right out of Daniel. And they're used several times in the book of Daniel. Now we're going to stop there in this particular section. I'd like you to turn with me to Daniel chapter 11. And tonight and next week and the following week, we'll be looking at the sections that the Lord Jesus had in mind when he was saying these things. If you're a note taker, I'd like you to note three things right up front from what we just looked at in Mark 13. And it's important to build on the information that you have. Sometimes in order to get wisdom from what's being said or what's being read in the scriptures, you need to take the time to build on what you know. It doesn't all come on the bottom shelf, contrary to popular belief. You really do need to build on what you know in order to learn some things. So note these three things and then bear them in mind as we look at what's going on in Daniel. The first is this. Jesus saw Israel at the center of the end. Jesus sees Israel at the center of things at the end of the age. What is going to be the sign that these things are going to happen, Lord? And he quotes from Daniel about the abomination of desolation. Now that tells you something. If you know the book of Daniel, you know that the abomination of desolation is something that will be set up in Israel, notably in Jerusalem. So whatever's going to happen has to do with Israel. Israel is at the center of things at the end of time. Number two, Jesus saw much destruction before the end. It will get worse before it gets better. You should notice that. And he says, do not panic and do not jump to the conclusion that just because there's wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and so on, that therefore he's coming right this minute. And unfortunately, that's been one of the difficulties is people will read this and then they'll count the number of earthquakes. I kid you not, I've read books where they counted the number of earthquakes and demonstrated that they were increasing. I don't know that they are increasing, actually. It's just that we're increasingly able to find them when they happen because of technology. Whatever the case, be careful. He says, don't panic and don't believe just any old person that comes by and says that this is the end. Look how bad it is. He says, these things actually have to happen. He saw much destruction before the end. It gets much worse before it gets better. And we're going to see some of that section this evening. And third, Jesus saw Daniel as a paradigm for understanding the end. He saw the book of Daniel as a paradigm for understanding the end. A lot of people try to figure out what's going to happen in the world without appealing to the scriptures. And a lot of folks, even intramurally among Christians, argue back and forth about how to interpret prophecy and so on. But let me just point something out. In the midst of these difficulties and these discussions, and so I know some of you have these discussions from time to time, and you'll sit around the dinner table and you'll say, well, I heard about this, about the Antichrist and the rapture and the this and the that. We're not going to talk about all of that tonight. We will talk about the Antichrist, though. When you get into those discussions, bear in mind that Jesus saw the book of Daniel as a paradigm for understanding the end. He saw the keys to understanding the end of time by looking into the book of Daniel, and that is rightly so. Once you read Daniel, you realize, even though there's a lot of other practical material in it, Some of the significant prophetic material is right here. And Jesus took it literally. He expected physical fulfillment of these things. And what you'll find many times among people who disagree about the end times is that some of them take it a little more literally than others. So I'll tell you, for my money, I take it as literally as I can within the context of the passages themselves. And that sometimes leaves quite a bit of wobble room as to how God might fulfill something. But it will tell you he certainly is planning to fulfill it in a very real physical way. How and in what nation and this and that, we may not know. But we do know, based on what we've seen in the book of Daniel, that when God says something's going to happen, by the time it happens, it is identifiable for what it is. In other words, it's not just all spiritualized as though that happened, but nobody knew. It's not like that. Jesus sees this. He sees the book of Daniel as a paradigm for seeing what the end will be. We know that because he quotes from, well, actually, as it turns out, probably Daniel 12, the reference to the abomination of desolation Jesus uses, probably from Daniel 12. Now, back into Daniel. We're going to pick up in verse 36 of chapter 11. And we're just going to go to the end of chapter 11, from 36 to 45. But let me bring you back up to speed as to what this is. There's in the book of Daniel, the last three chapters are all one revelation. It's not a vision like a movie that Daniel sees, similar to what John saw in the book of the Revelation. This is a talk that Daniel has with an angel, probably Gabriel, who speaks to Daniel and explains certain things in answer to Daniel's prayers. Daniel had been praying for Israel. This angel comes and speaks to Daniel and says, here are some of the things that are going to happen in the future. And so the things that the angel says cover the last three chapters of the book of Daniel. A huge percentage of the book are the angelic words. So note that it's given by an angel. It is not a vision. The angel's actually saying something to Daniel, and Daniel is able to write it down. Secondly, it involves Israel's fate and the fate of the earth. I mentioned this last time. And the time before. Note that this isn't just about Israel, it's also about the world itself, the end of the age, because the fate of Israel and the fate of the world are apparently tied together in some way. The fate of Israel is what is at stake, and you will see that very clearly when we get into chapter 12 next week. But all the way through here, this is about what happens to Israel. And in a lot of ways, only incidentally, do we then extrapolate from that what might be happening on the world scene? It's really about what's going to happen in what he calls the beautiful land. When a Jewish writer speaks of the beautiful land, I'll give you three guesses which land he has in mind. It's Israel. So it involves Israel's fate and the fate of the whole world because of that. Now, oh, by the way, something I forgot to mention before. Remember when we were talking about Daniel's 70th week, that last seven-year period of time? You guys remember that? From Daniel chapter 9. As we worked our way through this, I forgot to mention that one of the reasons that people who speculate that the rapture or the removal of the church off of the earth, that's what the rapture is, the removal of the church off the earth, might happen before that seven-year period, in other words, the pre-tribulation rapture. One of the reasons that people hold that or speculate that that might be the case is because all of this stuff about Israel does not mention or even have room for the church. And that's what made people start to think, well, maybe the church has been removed. Because this is obviously about Israel, and it's obviously about political Israel. And so that's how the thinking came up. It is the intensely Israeli feeling to these things, and especially in Daniel's prophecies, that made people start to wonder, and they began to look around for other things that might point in that direction. So when you hear the argument about the pre-trib rapture versus the post-trib rapture, what you need to remember is no one verse solves that question. You may have found that out. There is no one verse that actually proves either. And that's because both positions are extrapolated from some deeper theological thinking. And the deeper thinking for the pre-trib rapture has to do with the fact that this is about Israel and not the church. And so that's how people started to think about it. And your salvation doesn't depend on your position regarding the pre-trib rapture. And God is not taking a vote. So he's going to make it happen when it happens. So this is an intramural debate that's fun to talk about. But note that the Israeli emphasis here is part of the thinking that goes into it. Third thing to note about this vision is that it, or this revelation to Daniel, is that it's incredibly accurate through verse 35. Now, we're going to find that it's accurate all the way through. But through verse 35, which is what we looked at last week, it's all history. And when you lay the history that actually happened over what the angel said to Daniel, it fits so perfectly that rationalists have had to say, we figured he wrote it after the fact, because it fits so perfectly. Estimates range, actually, in terms of fulfilled prophecies, estimates range anywhere from 38 fulfilled prophecies in the first 35 verses of chapter 11 to 120, depending on how you count them. But everybody agrees, even skeptics agree, that whatever is being said in the first part of what the angel says to Daniel is incredibly accurate as to what really happened in that part of the world up through 164 BC. And that's what we talked about last week. Up through 164 BC, when Antiochus Epiphanes, that terrible Greek ruler, stopped. He died. And that's where the accuracy suddenly stops. When you get into verse 36, suddenly he's talking about things that haven't happened yet. And we'll talk about that. So it's incredibly accurate up through verse 35. Fourth thing to note about the vision is that it has focused very heavily on that last ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes, the person we discussed last week. And if you're interested in him and missed last week, you want to get that CD. But then there's a mysterious break between verses 35 and 36. Now, the difficulty in interpreting this whole section is that you can't tell from the context that in verse 36, he's not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. You can't tell from the context. In terms of what, when you study the scriptures and you read the various folks who make a living studying the scriptures, this creates a real problem. Because from through verse 35, it just click, click, click. You know who he's talking about all the way along. From verse 36 on, it's almost like he's not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, but you can't tell from looking at the text. It just moves very smoothly on into the rest of the vision. And if you didn't know your history, you would not know there was a difference between verse 35 and verse 36. You would assume he's talking about the same guy doing the same kind of battles. There's a king in the north. There's a king in the south. There's all this stuff. And so that's what gives people pause and makes them wonder what's going on. I'd like to begin reading in verse 36. I'm just going to read down through verse 45. Verse 36, then the king will do as he pleases. And the king in the context would appear to be Antiochus Epiphanes, the guy from 164 BC. The king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the wrath, or the indignation, same Hebrew word, until the wrath is finished. For that which is decreed will be done. That's an interesting line. And he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women. We'll get to that one. That's one everybody's interested in, that one. Nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above all of them. Instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold and silver and costly stones and treasures. And he will take action against the strongest of fortresses, and with the help of a foreign god, he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he will cause them to rule over the many and will parcel out land for a price. And then at the end of time, the king of the south, or the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he will enter countries and overflow them and pass through. And he will also enter the beautiful land, Israel, and many countries will fall, But these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, the foremost sons of Ammon. That's Jordan today. That's the nation of Jordan today, which apparently will escape some of the devastation that happens. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries. The land of Egypt will not escape, but he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt. The Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. North African allies, apparently, although some people think they might be actually enemies. Depends on how you interpret or translate the Hebrew there. Verse 44, but rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. So he's on his way to destruction to destroy what he thinks destroy everybody else. Verse 45, and he'll pitch his tents, the tents of his royal pavilion, between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. So he's camped in Israel during the last moment. And very typically, very cryptically, it doesn't say exactly what happens. It says he comes to his end and no one is there to help him. Boom, that's it. Don't you wish you knew more? Okay, let's go back and have a look at this. First of all, I think I would like to make the case for the fact that this is indeed future, because people do argue about it. Because of the fact that you can't tell the difference in the prophecy between verse 35 and verse 36, let me mention some reasons why you need to see this as future, and I do believe you need to. Number one, Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, does not fit this profile. The guy he's talking about in 36 and 37 doesn't fit Antiochus's profile. Antiochus was blasphemous, but he did not reject the God of his fathers. He still worshiped the Greek gods all the way to the end. And he also didn't die in Palestine. And this person dies in Palestine. He dies in Israel at the very end here. So Antiochus is not the person who's being spoken of beginning in verse 36. He is definitely the person up through verse 35, but apparently he's not beginning in verse 36. Second thing to notice is that the prophecy calls for fulfillment at the end of the days, at the end times, literally the end times, 11:35 and verse 40, and in chapter 12, verse 4, speaking of the resurrection. By the time he gets to verse 45 of chapter 11, he's talking about the end of this age. And we know that Antiochus Epiphanes did not live that long. So, second reason why. First, he doesn't fit the profile. Secondly, it definitely talks about the end of this age, and he hasn't been there. Third, the resurrection is mentioned immediately after this period. Look at verse 2 of chapter 12. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. It's talking about physical resurrection. We know that happens at the end of the age. And biblically, that's what it says happens at the end of the age. And we'll talk about that next week. So the resurrection is mentioned, and that seems odd in light of, I mean, it's just not part of the historical thing. Number four, there is a future time that does fit this description, and it is a time of great distress. Look at chapter 12, verse 1 of Daniel here. Now, at that time, Michael, the great prince, who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who's found written in the book, will be rescued. It's got to be the end of the age. And that has to be what is known as the Great Tribulation. Just nod if this is making a modicum of sense. Yes? Okay. So he's talking here about a period of time that is called a great period of tribulation. That is what Jesus talked about in the Olivet Discourse. And he mentions it very specifically in Matthew 24, when he calls it a time of distress like has never been before. So there is a time yet future that does fit this description. Number five, there is a future leader who does fit this profile. And you know where we're going with this, but I want you to see the passages. There is a future leader that fits this profile. He is known by three famous names. He's known as Antichrist in John 2, verse 18. John 2, verse, just jot it down. That's where John the Apostle says, you've heard the Antichrist is coming. And John says, in a lot of ways, he's already here, meaning his thinking is already here. You can read about it in John, 1 John. 1 John chapter 2, verse 18. He's also known as the man of lawlessness. In 2 Thessalonians, I want you to turn to this one in your New Testament, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now see, when you look at these, you realize, well, there is a guy who does appear at the end, even according to New Testament teaching, who fits the profile of this type of blasphemous, violent leader that Daniel's talking about. But this person that we're going to see is called Antichrist or Man of Lawlessness. He's not the same as Antiochus Epiphanes, but you can see the similarities. Verse 3 of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Let no one in any way deceive you. It will not happen or not come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. He's saying the second coming. You haven't missed it. Verse 4. Now, this man of lawlessness has to come. There's an evil person Paul's talking about here. Verse 4. And this person opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. That is exactly what a blasphemous leader does there in Daniel. Don't you remember, Paul says to the Thessalonians, while I was still with you, I was telling you these things. And you know what restrains him until now, so that in his time he may be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end. Now look at this. By the appearance of his coming. That is an end times thing. That is the second coming he's talking about. He's talking about killing a major world ruler when he comes back. A major world ruler is going to meet his doom when the Lord comes back. Verse 9. This person is the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with power and signs and false wonders, and with the deception of wickedness for those who perish. It's a rather, see those who perish? It's a rather matter-of-fact way to talk about what happens to the human soul in rebellion against God. And Paul speaks of it often and clearly and very matter-of-factly. And he says they will be deceived at that period of time into following this leader. Those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. We'll stop there. Let's go back to Daniel. So there is a future time and there is a future leader who does fit this profile. The third title for this person is the beast from Revelation 13, beginning in verse 1 and going to verse 8, which we don't have time, but jot it down. Revelation 13, 1 to 8. Now, if you read theology, you read commentaries and so on, you'll find that there are differences of opinion about the beast in Revelation 13, whether he's a person or whether he's a system. I am of the opinion that he is a person and that he's this person. The connection is quite remarkable. When you read it, if you go there, you will find that the same animals that are mentioned in Daniel are mentioned as characteristic of this beast in Revelation 13. You can read it when you get there. And now that you've been studying Daniel, you should recognize things about a leopard and a lion. Huh? You'll find some of that in there, but we don't have time tonight. So for those reasons, Antiochus IV doesn't fit the profile. The prophecy calls for fulfillment at the end of the time. The resurrection is mentioned immediately after this period. There is a future time that does fit this last seven-year period, apparently. And there's a future leader who does fit this profile. So for all those reasons, this is apparently who he's talking about. I'm probably preaching to the choir. You guys probably already agree with me that this is Antichrist. But there's a lot of folks you will talk to in intramural discussions that don't. And so I want you to know, if you're studying this, I want you to know why there are good reasons to see him this way. You also need to understand that this passage is, seeing him as the Antichrist, this is the traditional view. This has been the view in the church clear back into the second and third centuries. Clear back then, commentators and scholars and so on were saying, this guy has to be the Antichrist. Even people who disagree on when the rapture happens and even whether the rapture is going to happen. Amillennialists and premillennialists, if you know that terminology, they all pretty much agree this guy has to be the Antichrist. even though they may disagree on other things and timing and what happens to the church. This man that's being discussed here is this last ruler. Okay, having said all of that, let's look at his character and let's look at his last war, because that's what this is about. His character is in verses 36 to 39. His last war is in verses 40 to 45. Let's look at the character a little bit. Now, in a lot of ways, the Antichrist, this last ruler, personifies everything that's wrong with humanity. And he has all the power, he has all the wealth, he has everything that every human being would love to have, and he turns out terrible. Do you ever wonder why God doesn't give you everything you want? I'm really serious. Here's a guy who got it all, and this is what he did with it. So look at the character that's in this man. You'll see three outstanding characteristics: egotism, atheism, and materialism. Ringing any bells? Egotism, atheism, and materialism. Look at verse 36. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he'll prosper until the indignation is finished. For that which is decreed will be done. Notice the egotism. And by the way, he gets to do everything he wants. Any person who gets to do everything they want indefinitely will become a radical egotist, will end up worshiping themselves. They will magnify themselves. They get bigger than life. Just ask them. If they get everything they want. From the time our kids are about 2 years old, our main job, according to the Bible, is to teach them that the world does not revolve around them. And to teach them the word no. Why is that? Why do we have to teach kids that? Why is it that they never have self-centeredness lessons for kids in order to teach them how to be self-centered? It's because the human and the Antichrist is the perfect picture. He's the archetypical powerful human. He represents what we would be. We're going to get to this a little bit later. We need to understand that this person, this evil person, is not some person we would not be if we had the opportunity. Apart from the grace of God, one of the things I'm going to mention tonight is you would be this guy if it weren't for the grace of God. And I am convinced it's true, because when you look at the nature of humanity and you look at the Antichrist, he is humanity with all power. He's humanity in spades. He's the personification of us outside the grace of God. And that's why when God comes back, when the Lord comes back, he kills him. And that's just terribly sobering. It's just terribly sobering. I talked with a fellow not too long ago. In fact, I've had this discussion several times recently within the last year. And in which they were saying, well, you know, there's other religions and this and that. And how can you tell what the different, you know, how do you choose religions and so on? As if we're in some smorgasbord. We're it's like a religion mall where you pick the one you want, you know. And I said, well, look at evil. Who deals with evil? And it's not cosmic evil. It's evil in the human soul. Who deals with that? Only one. Really deals with and takes seriously the evil in the human soul. Now, you look at the way this king deals with life, and it totally revolves around him. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. He'll speak monstrous things against the God of gods, which will eventually happen always. You'll end up hating God. He will prosper until the indignation, the wrath, is finished. And that last line, remember I told you to have a look at it, for that which is decreed will be done. What that means is certain things have been decreed and they will happen. And the wrath that's being talked about here is not the wrath of the Antichrist. It's the wrath of God. Well, what do you mean? You mean God's at work through this guy? Absolutely. The wrath he's talking about is the wrath that God is going to bring about on the world in light of the world's sin. He uses sin to judge sin. And we've seen that over and over and over again. When you say to yourself, I want to be used by God, you need to specify for redemptive purposes, because God uses evil people to judge other evil people. I always have in my mind, and it's theologically correct. I know it is. Trust me. It's like this. It's like, have you ever seen a picture where you've got a bunch of fish, you've got a little tiny one, then you've got another one a bit larger with its mouth open following the tiny one. Then you've got another one behind that one with its mouth open a bit larger. Then you've got one with its mouth open a bit larger than that. And it just fills the paper. On one side of the paper is this great huge fish, And then they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And you know what's happening? They're all eating each other until the great one, the big one, eats them all. That's how God deals with sin. He lets evil in the world actually judge itself. And there's a poetic justice to that. But it is under his hand. Indeed, the wrath must be finished. That which is decreed will be done. God says, I know what I'm doing. What I have planned to happen is going to happen. And it's going to include, as we're going to see, this horrible period of time in among humanity. So, note the egotism in this man. Secondly, note the atheism, verse 37. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers. Apparently, he comes, people speculate, maybe he was Jewish, maybe he was from some other religion. There's no way to really tell. So when you get in that discussion, just say, and leave it at that. Whatever his background is, he's going to apostatize from it. He will come from apparently some spiritual background, but he's going to apostatize from it. He's going to become his own god. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women. What in the world does that mean? Nobody knows. It can mean the desire that women have. And it can mean the desire for women. But nobody really knows exactly what it means. But apparently it means something unnatural. Something that one would have expected but isn't there in this person's psyche, in their soul, in their thinking, in their personality. And that's about all you can say. Nor will he show regard for any other god. He will magnify himself above all of them. Magnify himself above all of them. Atheism is actually, by the way, self-worship. Atheism is self-worship. Remember that. You say, oh, well, that's just preacher's rhetoric. No, it's not. Atheism is when you say, I am sure there is no god. Well, how do you know that? My mind tells me so. Then where's your faith? In your mind. You are a legend in your own mind. It is a form of self-worship. Atheism is a form of self-worship. This man certainly worships himself. But outwardly, he is essentially an atheist, and he then turns himself into an object of worship and makes use of religion for the masses. But he himself doesn't believe it. Here's the third. The third characteristic is materialism, 38 and 39. And along with the materialism, militarism. He actually worships his army. Instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whose fathers did not know. He'll honor him with gold and silver, costly stones and treasures. And man, a big high-tech army is one expensive thing. And he pours the money into it because this is what he believes is really going to save him, is his army. He is a worshiper of the military. Incidentally, did you know that's where the term chauvinism originally came from? The term chauvinism meant unbounded confidence in the military. It became a term about men for some reason or other. I don't know how that happened, but it originally was this. This guy's in the original technical idea, this is the original chauvinist. This is a guy whose real faith is not in God. It's in himself and in his own ability to inflict his will upon anybody because he has a huge army. He's very much into his power. And if you have seen the destruction that humanity can do with a large army, you can see why the person in charge of that army might get the impression that they could run the world. I mean, really and truly. It must be heady stuff to see millions of men and women fighting at your command and to see the technology of war happening because you said, do it. And suddenly there is war. Imagine that. And imagine what that would do to your head to have that kind of power. Well, it does it to his head. And it makes it really, really big. He is a materialist par excellence. He believes in the material world. He believes in his own power. He believes in what he can get. He uses his wealth to get more. Verse 39, he will take action against the strongest of fortresses, and with the help of a foreign god. What does that mean? He has demonic help. He has demonic help to get some of this done. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him. He uses the power to reward those who help him. And he will cause them to rule over the many, and he parcels out land for a price. So as a good politician, a good power broker, he gives away big chunks of the world, so to speak. And that's what his intent is. His intent is to take over the world. But look at his character: egotism, atheism, and materialism. I am what matters. It is my mind and my mind only that determines right from wrong. And I believe in the physical world first and foremost. My friend, this guy would do very well in our country. This guy would succeed in our country. He would be on a lot of TV shows. You know, it just occurred to me, he'd make a great apprentice. You know? I'm surprised at the popularity of that show. Well, there you have his character. What about his last war? Verses 40 to 45. At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him. Who's the king of the south? I have no idea. In the prophecy previous to this, the king of the south was somebody in Egypt. And because it was the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, remember? If you remember from last time. Apparently, this is a king who does war against the Antichrist, not necessarily out of righteousness. Now, remember that these guys want to take over the world, and there's always competition for that position, okay? And so, not necessarily because this king of the south is a righteous person, but there's a war that involves this other king. And they have this huge battle, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and horsemen. King of the north might be the Antichrist. I believe that it is a reference to the Antichrist himself, but there's some question about that. Might be a different king. At any rate, there's this huge war with horsemen and with many ships. He will enter countries and overflow them and pass through, just taking one country after another, boom, 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 like the Blitzkrieg in World War II, just boom, 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 and nations falling quickly in front of him. And he will enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued. And he mentions Jordan. And Jordan, of course, is, maybe he doesn't care what happens to Jordan, because the action, if it's happening in Egypt and North Africa, and if the battle lines are coming down from the north, they're going to run over Israel. They're not going to run over Jordan. They're going to come down through that section like all armies always have in that part of the world, right down through the middle of Israel. And so he finds himself in Israel. Now, Jerusalem becomes very much a part of this. But I want you to notice it's really for the power of the whole world. It's not just about taking Jerusalem. This last ruler wants to take over the whole world. And he gets stopped at Jerusalem, sort of stumbles over Jerusalem. In Zechariah chapters 12, 13, and 14, it says that God says to Jerusalem about it, I will make you a weight around the neck of the world and the kings of the world. I will draw them to you. I will make Jerusalem this big stumbling stone. That's what happens to the Antichrist during this war. He will stretch out his hand against other countries. The land of Egypt will not escape. He will gain control over hidden treasures of gold and silver, over the precious things. He apparently wins that war with the king of the south. And he'll take the things from Egypt and from North Africa, the Libyans and the Ethiopians. Verse 14, then rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him. It's an interesting thing. Revelation 9 talks about 200 million man army from the east causing havoc. I'm not going to make any more connections than that, but it is interesting. Rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him. He will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He'll end up pitching his tents of the royal pavilion between the seas in Israel by the holy mountain, and he'll come to his end, and no one will help him. According to Revelation 16, there is one final horrible battle that takes place in the Jezreel Valley, also known as the Valley of Megiddo, or Armageddon. And that's the battle that takes place, except he doesn't describe the battle here. It is Armageddon, and you might want to cross-reference Revelation 16, verses 13 to 16, if you're interested in where in the book of Revelation this is discussed. And I hold a futuristic view of the book of Revelation. I teach the book as a description of the last 7 years, for the most part, between chapters 4 and 19. So I really think that chapter 16 of Revelation describes what's happening in verse 45 of Daniel 11, and it is Armageddon. It is not just one battle, by the way. When you put all of the material together, it's a war that lasts up to 3.5 years and ends with the destruction of this leader right here. It's a kind of a sad thing. Did you see the last line of verse 45? And no one's there to help him. What a terrible thing for a human being to suddenly realize, I've made an enemy of God and there's no one to help me. Think about that. Think about that. I've made an enemy of God and there's no one to help me. Can you imagine? Is there any amount of power or wealth or pleasure that this world could offer? And this guy had it all. Is there any amount that could make it worth that to be standing alone in eternity and to say, I've made an enemy of God and there's no one to help me? I mean, it just is. To me, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. And that's the way he ends. There's no one to help him, and he ends in Israel. I jot down Zechariah 12, 13, and 14, if you haven't already, and look at it when you get a chance. Our time is gone. But you can read a lot about this period at that time. Tonight's Bible study has been essentially about Daniel 11 and essentially about this person, the Antichrist, this leader who meets his end so horribly, but who up until that time looked like the epitome of human success. And I want to close with some thoughts from the Antichrist. Can you learn anything from the Antichrist? Yeah, I think you can. There are at least two things we can learn. And you might want to jot them down. Here's the first. People are never really faithless. They just transfer their faith from God to something else. People are never really faithless. This man was not faithless. Now remember, I'm playing a little game here. I'm changing the definition of faith. If I say faith to you, normally I mean faith in God, and so do you. But let's back it up a little bit. When I say people are never really faithless, what I mean is this. They're never really self-sufficient. They always have to trust somebody. Human beings always have to trust somebody. The question is who they're going to trust. So there's no such thing as a truly faithless person. There's just such a thing as a person who decides not to trust God and decides to trust himself or trust an idol or trust a false religion or a false philosophy or war itself or wealth or power, whatever the case. But Antichrist is a classic example of a person who you would say is faithless but isn't really faithless. They've just taken faith from God. They said, God says we're created to trust him. And until we do trust him, we will never have peace. And we say, well, I don't want to trust you because I want to compete with you. I want to be God. I don't want to be godly. I want to be God. So where are you going to put your faith? In yourself. In your own thinking, in your own philosophy, or whatever the case may be. People are never really faithless. They simply transfer faith to something other than God. Hebrews 11, 6. Romans 1, 21. Just jot them down and have a look at them when you get a chance. The reason, by the way, that you have to live by faith and you were created to live by faith is because you're not omniscient. You are a creature. You trust somebody. You trust a lot of people. You take the word of a lot of people for life in general. And you will always have to do that. There's only one person who does not have to live by faith. Only one person in the universe who does not have to live by faith. Who? The Lord. God. Why? Because he does know it all. Now think about it. It's true. He's the only one who knows it all. Everybody else has to live by faith. The angels have to trust him or not and become demons. Humans have to trust him or not and die with the demons. So when a person says, I've decided I don't believe in God and I don't trust God, what the person is saying is, I've decided to be God. And that's why the Lord takes it so personally. And that's why the Antichrist is really exactly what we would be. God takes that personally. For a creature to say, I don't need you, God, is to say, I am God, and to be the Antichrist. That is terribly sobering. So when you witness to somebody and you share the Lord with them, do you know what you're telling them to do? You're telling them to take the faith out of themselves and put it in God. You're telling them to stop trusting whatever it is they're trusting and start trusting the Lord and what he said through his son, Jesus Christ. That's what you're doing. And if they do it, if they come, they will live forever. And if they don't, there will come a day when they will be alone and there will be no one there to help them. And you wouldn't wish that really on your worst enemy, honestly. People are really not faithless. They just transfer their faith in the wrong direction. And that is our problem. Here's the second thing. The competition for your soul, therefore, in light of that, what we just said, competition for your soul is not between God and other gods or Satan and God. It's not like God is there bidding for you with Satan or with some other god trying to get your loyalty. Competition is between God and you. It's between God and you and me. When a person thinks about the Lord, it's not like the Lord is in the, like I said, in the supermarket of religion, and he just has a better booth than anybody else, and he offers better benefits, and we're selling him, you know, because it's so cool to know God. And someone will come along and say, well, it's cooler to know Baal, and that's exactly what sold Baal to the people in the Old Testament. The problem with Baal is that he doesn't exist. And the problem with all the stuff we think is competing for us, it doesn't exist. I'll tell you where the competition is, between us and God. And that's the way it was with Antichrist. It was between him and God. The other gods don't exist. Only the God of the universe exists, the real one, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. So when a person says, I don't want to trust God, that's competition between them and God. Everyone else is out of the picture. And ultimately, that's all that will matter. So conversion and walking with the Lord means living in that wisdom. It's going to end. This whole thing's going to come down. That's what Jesus said. And all the stuff that Antichrist and our world says is so worth it. So cool and so worth it. The problem with it all is that not a bit of it goes past the grave. We are terminal, and there's only one person with that answer. Antichrist thinks that he can do it all and survive. And God says, have you not noticed everybody dies and has to answer to me? When we are tempted by the same things that really turned his crank, that really made him work, you know, the egotism and the power, the wealth, the materialism, the self-worship that our culture really lives in to a very great extent. And we are tempted by those things. You are, I am, we've been raised in it. When we are, and then the Lord says, I'm taking some of it away from you, I'm going to pop your ego, I'm going to put you into bankruptcy, I'm going to take this away, I'm going to change the plan. And we think, oh no, I'm being destroyed. Chances are excellent we're not being destroyed, we're being delivered. Chances are excellent the Lord is teaching us how to think like people who know him and trust him. Chances are excellent that even the difficulties in this world are there to help us as believers so that we don't put our faith here. That is Antichrist. We put our faith there. We trust the Lord. Let's pray. Father, thank you for reminding us these sobering things. We look at this man and we are accustomed to thinking of him in evil tones, of course, but then we see how much like him we are, and so is our world and our culture. Not just our country in many ways, but the entire world, wherever we go, we see his personality. We see the idolatry, and we see the egotism, and we see the materialism, and the worship of power. And it reminds us, Lord, of how useless these things are in eternity. And we don't want to stand alone with no one to help us. Thank you for coming to be with us. Thank you for delivering us. Thank you for bringing the gospel and teaching us to think above these things. We pray that we will think above these things and that we will make our decisions based on your wisdom, because we know we're going to die. We know that we won't be here. We'll be with you, and how we look forward to it. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In Jesus' name, amen.